Lowe's knows laundry day should be easy. Achieve maximum versatility with a dryer door that swings open either way, making load transfer from washer to dryer a breeze. Plus, with LG ThinQ, save time by controlling your washer remotely. Shop LG, America's most reliable line of home appliances, today at Lowe's. Based on independent reliability surveys 2021 to 2024 and select major appliances as compared to competing manufacturers offering full appliance lines. See associate for more details. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, exclusions apply. Valid 6/18 through 7/9.
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. And once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long-term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.
You don't need to be ripped. You just need the right shirt. Epic Fits gives you a clean, confident silhouette. Snug on the arms, soft on the skin, generous where it counts. And with deals like $15 per tee, they won't break the bank. Visit epicfits.com today. Epic Fits, t-shirts that get it.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
Some secrets are kept in the basement, others in the morgue. Welcome to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, featuring defense attorney and host of the podcast, Defense Diaries, Bob Mata.
The trial of Richard Allen, of course, has come to a close, a case that we've been following for you really ever since our podcast has existed. It's a case that has had many questions about the guilt or the innocence of a man named Richard Allen, charged in the 2017 murders of Abigail Williams and Liberty German in Delphi, Indiana. A guilty verdict rendered this week to a stunned courtroom after many felt the prosecution did not bring a very strong case. And the defense, that had their arms tied behind their back by a judge who didn't want, it seems, any type of exculpatory evidence or, I don't know, evidence in general, maybe about 75% of it, in the ears of the jurors. We're going to talk to three experts in their own respective fields here today about this case, where it went, and what's next for Richard Allen. We're going to have Bob Mata, defense attorney, join us in just a moment, followed by Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author. And then we're going to talk to the former FBI special agent, Robin Drake, who was head of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, for his take on this case as well. We'll start by going to Bob Mata. Bob, you were there in the courthouse every single day. Take us there. Take us to your reporting and how this case eventually wrapped up into closing arguments and then us getting into that guilty verdict.
Yeah, it was it was a bit of a whirlwind towards the end. Like, there was, I think, a little bit of surprise how quickly the defense ended its case in chief.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, even some of the jurors, I saw some raised eyebrows when Brad Rosie, one of the defense attorneys, said the defense rests. They're like, really? You know, so I think that took the jury by surprise a little bit. It took me by surprise a little bit as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we kind of went into the verdicts and the deliberations, you know, it was a wild atmosphere out there. I mean, there was always a big crowd out there. I did a bunch of lives, like, mm-hmm. man on the street interviews, just trying to talk to anybody and everybody. that would be willing to talk to me on the lives. And it was really interesting, man. It was interesting. Tons of locals, tons of Indiana residents, you know, just to kind of hear what their thoughts were on this thing. And, you know, a lot of people were of the same mindset because I was not cherry picking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? These were folks I didn't know. I mean, obviously I talked to, you know, some of the other lawyers and YouTubers that were there, but in terms of just the citizens that I spoke to, many, many of them, a majority of them were of the same mindset that you are. And I think that you're seeing that post verdict online as well. Just a lot of people are like, wow, this is a thing. And, you know, it's truly my hope that someday, that the videos of Richard Allen in his cell are made public so that people can have a real understanding of what happened in this case and how an American citizen was treated in that prison for 13 months, not just solitary, but just allowing him to remain in there, knowing that he was psychotic was, excuse me, beyond inhumane, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the world deserves to see it, that in order to try to secure a verdict under the guise of trying to keep him safe, that they allowed that to happen, and not only allowed it to happen, but really put everything in place for it to happen. Mm-hmm. I think that people are going to be way more shocked than they are just sitting back, kind of hearing about it. It's kind of one of those things you have to see it to believe it.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about that because obviously we've been talking about this for more than a year while he was in solitary confinement. And that really seemed to be the big thing that we were talking about. He gets almost a new trial free card just because of the abuse that was in there. Obviously they're going to appeal this, but is there any legal recourse for the treatment that he received in that prison? Is there anything that can be done, whether he's free or not? Because it just seems to me that no matter what, this was not how they should have been operating, period. And it shouldn't sway on the verdict.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is, I mean, certainly they can try to file suit against, you know, the IDOC, against Centurion, who was the one who put, you know, his psychologist in there, who has got a lot of issues in terms of her treatment. I mean, she was digging into his case like long before he became her patient and continued to dig in after he was her patient and was relaying information to him that we'll never know.
Yeah.
What exactly she said and what she didn't say. We cause she destroyed all of her written notes, you know, so we're left with what she says, and what she put into the system, you know, claiming that it was from her notes, you know, but I mean, with any kind of lawsuit against the IDOC, you've got, you know, governmental immunity. It's very difficult. And frankly, at this point, as a convicted felon, any kind of recompense he'll get, sorry, I got a frog in my throat. Any kind of recompense he'll get probably would go to the families in restitution.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they would probably file suit and say, okay, well, if he gets any money, we want it in restitution. So I don't know that there's ever going to be anything that's going to be able to be done about it. You know, I think that the best remedy is going to be exposure of what happened in our country with this case and this individual, and that people become outraged and we put our foots down and we say that this is not the country that we live in. This is not what our Constitution says should happen to the people that are presumed innocent. And, you know, we've got to fight back. Like, we can't allow that to start happening. Is that going to become the norm?
Yeah.
Now they're like in a case like this, they're going to say, you know what? We made it through with Richard Allen and we got that verdict. You know, in every case where you got circumstantial evidence, not real powerful, let's try throwing him in prison. Let's see if we could break him for, you know, 13 months. Let's see if we can get it done there. Let's see if we can get those confessions. You know, is that our new MO? Is that what's going to become the norm? I don't know. I mean, I hope not.
Yeah. But I mean, it kind of does set a precedent where this bit worked. I mean, you're not breaking him. That's the thing. And I know you're not saying that yourself, but there's ignorant people out there who think that by doing this, you're going to break him and he's going to, no, you're going to break him, but you're not going to get accurate information out of him. You're going to break him.
Right.
Full stop.
And you'll get whatever
you get out of that, but none of it's valid because you broke someone.
Right. Which is frankly going to be probably the most fervently battled issue in the appeals, like whether or not those are voluntary, whether or not they're valid, you know, like the appeal is going to really focus on everything. The appellate court, unlike the gallery, is going to get to see the videos of his incel because they were put into evidence. So the appellate court, and if it doesn't make it there to the Indiana Supreme Court, they're going to look at it. And I hope that they're outraged. Mm-hmm. I would hope that they're outraged. I hope that they put their foot down and they say, nope, no, this isn't how we do it here. This is not our country. You know, it was inhumane, Tony. That's all I can tell you, man. Yeah. It was unbelievable.
The appeals process for Richard Allen now underway. Give us some insight, Bob, on how this is going to work from here.
It's lengthy, you know, and like before I kind of dive into that, I think that the number one concern is going to be are they going to be able to keep Rick Allen alive to survive through the appellate process? There is going to be zero incentive on part of the state to keep him alive. And anybody who knows anything about our prison system knows that convicted child killers and convicted pedophiles are not treated very kindly within the walls of those prisons. So, I mean, he's in peril. He's going to be in absolute peril. You know, so that's the first thing. And then it's going to be a lengthy process. You know, there's going to be some motions filed initially in court after sentencing happens on December 20th. You know, they'll try to get them a new trial. They'll file a motion. The defense team will file a new motion that'll get denied by Gull. And then at that point, you got to start getting the record together. And the record it's a massive undertaking. So they have to transcribe all of the every day of testimony. They got to put everything together and they've got to create this record that they then ship off to the appellate court and said, here's the case. And it's not just the trial, it's everything pre-trial. Mm-hmm. So all the things that we were always kind of barking about, like what's Gull doing here, those are all part of the appellate record as well. It starts from basically the minute of arrest up through the verdict, and then through that last post-conviction motion that's going to be filed. And then they're going to go through it, you know, and then the briefs will be written first by Allen's appellate attorneys, and then the state will then have their ability to respond. And then at that point, the appellate court will make a decision whether or not, you know, that they find that the confessions are valid. And in my opinion, if they do find that they're valid, it's going to be problematic because I think that they'll say that the weight of those confessions outweighs any of the other issues where she may have ruled wrong, but it wouldn't have mattered at trial because of the fact that there's all these confessions that we think are valid, that those would have been the thing that sealed this case for any jury. So they would rule everything else as harmless error and not give them another trial. At that point, once that's denied, then you got to go up to the Indiana Supreme Court and have them take the same look at it. You file new briefs. Mm-hmm. And from that point forward, if that gets denied, then you shift it over to the federal system.
It's lengthy, man. Yeah, I mean, how long could this all take? If he's to get a new decade. Trial, what would you think?
Decade, easily.
Wow.
Take a decade. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're talking about he's what, 54, I believe. Is that correct? So he'd be about 64 then by if he survives. We're not talking surviving, you know, a couple months here to get this worked out. We're talking a decade. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Dude, this is, you know, depending on what the direct appeal would that have, like the direct appeal. I mean, maybe a year, year and a half, 2 years, we'll get a ruling on that. But like I said, like getting to the point where you're getting the briefs done.
Yeah.
It's like in all honesty, probably going to take a year, you know, maybe longer. And then it gets scheduled. I don't know if the appellate court will want argument or if they'll just go on the briefs themselves. You know, but it's just a lengthy process, man. It's like I talk to you about, tell you about it all the time. It's like once you're convicted in this country, it is a Herculean task to undo it.
Did the appellate courts ever look at some of the rulings and some of the things that Gull did? Did they ever like, what the hell was this? Like, why would you make that? I mean, is there ever criticism of any? Does it even matter? Is there any checks and balances to a judge like Gull, where she did make some pretty bizarre rulings that did seem to make a whole lot of sense? But is there anybody to check and go, why? Why did you make that? Like, what's your thinking? Or is it just
the appellate level? That's it. Like that. That's where they're going to decide.
Be free to continue to do this to other cases over and over and over. And there's nothing that seems to be such a broken system that you can get somebody bad in there, and then there's not really any recourse to stop them.
I obviously could not agree more. Yeah. And I appreciate your outrage, man. It's like, I wish there were, and you're not alone in feeling that way. It's like I said, if you kind of take the temperature right now, like online, of what people are feeling about this case, I think a lot of people echo your sentiments, and we should all be afraid.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, that's my entire point. I mean, we have to watchdog cases like this. And I honestly cannot remember. And I'm going to pose a question to you.
Yeah.
Can you remember a case maybe ever in where you have this big of a split in terms of whether or not even if he did it, but whether or not they met their burden? And people don't even really understand what the burden is, but they know enough to know that something's not right about how this went down.
No.
You know, it's like people just have a feeling. Like I can't think of any other murder trial that I've watched where I was like, I don't know what's
going on. How did this even get to court is like where I'm at. Like, this doesn't even make, like, there was nothing. There was nothing up their sleeve. There was nothing where it was like, oh, okay, I see why they think it. It was like even more confirmation that they didn't know what they were doing in this trial. Even more than less confidence that we had going into it.
I know, man. And it's like, like the only silver lining out of this case, and I hate for it to be, you know, that an individual has to go through it, and I hope that he survives it, is that it really shines a light on our system.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that it's a broken system. I mean, it's the only system we have. I don't know that there's any system that's better anywhere else.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's not broken.
Yeah,
and it's like, dude, we've been just we lost a generations of people of color like to the system that like just kept entire generations of black people and people of color down just by imprisoning, you know, who would typically be the breadwinner like up until, you know, they finally started giving women some rights in our country. You know what I mean? It's you can kind of look and see the way that it goes, and it's scary, and it's been scary. I mean, that's why I got into criminal, the defense side of it. Yeah. I wanted to protect our, try to do, you know, what I could from the inside.
Sure.
You know, to try to, but frankly, I have a much louder voice out here than I ever did in the courtrooms, man. Sure. And I see it all the time on my YouTube channel and my podcast with emails that people send me. People are like, man, you really opened my eyes. And that's all you can ask for, is to have people start to get an understanding of what's really going on with this system. And it doesn't have to be about conspiracy theories, man. It's about how the system operates. You know, it's about privatized prisons. It's about, there's a lot of moving parts. It's not a search for truth anymore. It's a search for just convictions from prosecutors all over this country. They don't care about the truth. They care about getting a conviction on their case. That's what their mandate is from their bosses.
Yeah.
They need that because those bosses have to get reelected, and they want to be able to put, our conviction rate is 97%. That's what we're keeping you safe. That's what it's such a thing, man, that I'm just grateful that more people are willing to listen and willing to critically think about what's going on and maybe getting active about it and being a voice, because we the people, that's all we got.
Yeah, I mean, that's 100% true. And I just think so many people are unaware of how broken the system is. And it's not that it can't, there's not room for improvement, because it seems like a lot of these things, it would be simple. It wouldn't be that complicated to put some more checks and balances in here, because inevitably you're going to have some bad people in there that are going to have power, and that needs to be checked out when that happens, right, and then corrected. And it can be done, but it's so broken where it just can run free endlessly, and we all stand on the sideline watching the train barreling towards the truck on the railroad track that isn't moving. And it's like, yeah, push it, move it, do something. Like, it's against the rules. We can't push it right now. Press the gas. They're not allowed to press the gas.
I know. And it's not even just bad people or people with ill intent. It's people that are not competent to be doing the jobs that they're doing. That's scarier than anything else, because there's going to be a way more of those than there are people coming in with bad intentions.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're going to be dealing with people that should not be in the position they're in, either because they're not qualified to do it, or they're not suited to do it. One of those two things. And then the end result are just life-shattering decisions that are made. And you see it in every level of, you know, the criminal justice system. You see it everywhere, though. I mean, you see it in even in family courts, where you've got judges that probably shouldn't be on the bench that are making decisions that are just so impactful on people's lives. You know, like we're making decisions where children should be placed, you know, like, and you have a judge who's heard 2 hours of evidence and making an absolutely like life altering decision for a family, you know, and it's like based on, it's scary, man. It's scary. And I obviously agree. I mean, we need to tinker with it. And you know, the answers are not that clear.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like, maybe the answer is robots. maybe AI is the one who takes over the criminal justice system.
I've been very curious about that idea. I think it'd be very interesting to run a full trial, everything, just through something, and then at the end, let the AI be the juror. See what?
Well, because I'd love to see some test samples of it, or the judge. Like where they've just like AI has just taken in all the existing case law, processed it. Because one thing that you know about computers is they're not going to be biased.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's going to logically analyze the information that it's receiving. And then it's going to say, well, based on this, like this is the correct answer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So like it's a terrifying prospect, but it's an interesting one.
Well, I mean, it's a great way that, you know, all the research that would have used to have been done, now it's like, boom, here we go. AI can pull it up, different case law, everything, and find really good examples much faster or better than humans ever could.
Right.
And so, I mean, there's a lot of benefits there. It'll make, just as anything, it's like, does more information make it better? We're in a world where we have access to literally anything we want to know in our pockets. And people seem more misinformed today than ever.
I know. Well, you know, because now it's people are allowed to put misinformation out there.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, now you have to be able to try to cull through what's real and what's not real, what's true and what's not true, mm-hmm. because everybody that puts something out there states it as fact.
Yeah.
You know, and then you've got the layer on top of that is, okay, so who's actually controlling, you know, the Snopes of the world and all the different, you know, the like fact finding to, you know, like to determine whether or not something's true or not true. Are they biased?
Yeah.
You know, it's like layer upon layer of bias that you're just, you can't know, you know, it's like, it's a weird world we live in, man. It's a weird, weird world.
Let's go back to the case for a moment and talk about the defense ending rather quickly. And you said you were kind of surprised by this. Everyone was surprised. Why do you think that is? On the outside looking in, what my reaction was, oh, I think the prosecution already sunk themselves. Let's not keep adding more to the fire, which could steer us in another way. And let's, less is more is kind of what I was thinking. What was your thoughts being actually there?
It's so hard to know, you know, because it's like you look at it like, and it was the first time I had ever sat on that side of the bar where I'm not in the well of the courtroom trying the case from beginning to end. Like, obviously I've streamed a bunch of trials. It's different when you're there. Yeah. It just is. You're seeing more. You know, even though I was at the disadvantage of having to write the whole time, trying to transcribe this trial as best as I could, but you have this dilemma of the confessions. So you had to deal with them in some way, shape, or form. And you know, like, how do you balance how much of the state's what I consider to be weak case in terms of evidence? Pulling, if you pull the confessions out of it and you're like, okay, well, they basically have mirror presence at the bridge and you have a few eyewitnesses that all give different descriptions of a different person, at least in my estimation.
Yeah.
And then you got this unspent casing. So you've got to deal with those independently, but also understanding that the most powerful evidence at the end of the day is going to be those confessions. Mm-hmm. And then you're kind of looking at it from the defense perspective. You're like, how much do we put on? Do we put Kathy Allen on? Do we need to give this jury an understanding of where Rick was for the rest of the day? Like what was his demeanor when I got home from work? You know, like, frankly, and I'm sure that was the toughest decision for the defense, whether or not to put her on, mm-hmm. you know, and it could have been Rick Allen, who's very protective of his wife, saying, I don't want her involved with this, do not put her on the stand. I don't know. I mean, ultimately, that's a strategy decision by the attorneys, not the client. Personally, I leaned on the side that was a mistake not putting her on, because I think the jury needed to hear what was going on with Rick when she got home from work. What was he doing? Who does the laundry? You know, was there any laundry being done? Was there, you know, did he leave that night? Was he acting strange? Like, all those things that you could have asked her, because the way it kind of went down is you never really heard where Rick Allen was that whole day.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of left at that, which strategically, when you're kind of looking at the microcosm of the case and you're shrinking it down to the period of time in which the state believes the girls were killed, which is why I was like, you attack the timeline. Mm-hmm. You know, you attack the timeline. They could not prove when the girls died. The only information that they were using was saying that Libby's Apple Health data, her phone data, said that the phone stopped moving in such and such a time. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that that's when the girls died.
No.
It just doesn't, you know? And it's like, you get this kind of like stunning evidence brought in at the very last minute by the defense, with this phone being plugged in, that the headphone port was accessed from 5:22 to 10, and then unplugged at 10:23. You've got, you know, their phone data guy going down and Googling, you know, in a 15-minute break and coming up and testifying, oh, I Googled that can be from water damage or dirt. And like, why wasn't that looked at?
Yeah.
Like what, are you telling me that at no point during the 7 years of investigation that no one ever with this thought that the girls crossed the creek? Like that at some point that they were forced to cross the creek. Like, don't you want to just see if the phone had water damage just to support that proposition alone, without even thinking about this thing that they may have found or that they did find in the data?
Yeah.
You know, like, don't, how was that never done? Like, in the search for the truth, like, my biggest takeaway from this trial is that this investigation was not good. Like that, and we all knew that going in, but it was substantiated at trial. You know, it's one thing to hear about it and hear everybody speculate about it. It's another thing to hear it come into evidence. You know, the amount of lost interviews, the amount of things that weren't done, the amount of things that they did at trial. Like, they get a jury question about, oh, did you ever go and see how many Ford Focuses were, you know, in the area? You know, black Ford Focuses were in the area at the time, and they hadn't done that. Mm-hmm. And they do it after they get that jury question in the middle of trial.
Yeah.
You know, and then they only provide the information on a real limited scope. Like, they don't talk about all the cars that look like Ford Focuses. You can't tell what kind of car that is.
Well, one of the pieces from afar that I was kind of taken aback by was the individual, I believe it was an officer, who testified about the voice on the bridge and the voice on the video and Richard Allen. and just basically stating, I believe that's him. Okay, how? How have you verified this? What testing have you done on the voice to compare it? Was there any testing? This is just literally his opinion from what I've understood.
Yeah.
That's no, it. Exactly. And dude, presented as fact.
Presented as if this guy, like, and I mean, obviously they crossed him. Do you have any training? Do you have any education to make that kind of assessment on the stand in the middle of a trial? And he's like, no, I don't have any of that. And then she allows that opinion to come in. I was like stunned.
Yeah.
And I was like stunned. I was absolutely, I couldn't believe it.
How many times did you just want to stand up
and
yell?
That's like me putting you on the stand, Tony, and saying, hey, man, you're like, Tony, yeah, I listened to it. I listened to it 100 times, maybe more. And I had headphones on. Oh, okay. And then you listen to the audio from that video. Okay. And then Tony, in your expert opinion, because you listened to so many times, is that the same voice?
Yeah. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It
must be. Unequivocally, it's the same voice.
Yeah.
I'm like, am I in crazy world?
Yeah. It felt like, what are we doing here? Like, how is this being presented as fact? Like, we have things. We have tools to do these tasks.
Right. why not get somebody to figure out the height of the bridge guy? Like, either way.
There's ways of doing these things.
There's 100% ways to do it. And they chose not to do it. Like, that came out on testimony. Like, it was like 10 grand. We decided because of the error, the error rate that we decided not to do it. I'm like, oh, man, I don't know, man. I don't know. It was just a thing. So I don't know. It's all going to come out on appeal, though.
All
of it, we're going to hear about it all on appeal. The nice thing about the appeal is that they're going to have to make the transcripts. So I want the world to read the transcripts.
Yeah.
You know, I did the best I could. Yeah. Andrea did the best that she could. You know, lawyerly, we all did the best that we could to transcribe every word that you can, but you can't do it.
No,
it's impossible. You know, and you know, the world deserves to know what went on in that courtroom, word for word. You know, so like this thing's not over. Like,
no.
Which is unfortunate for the families, but that's part of the process. You know,
I was so hoping, because initially going in, I thought, well, maybe it could go either way. Then the way it was going, I was thinking he's going to get off. Like, this is great that they can kind of move on and hopefully actually go after who actually did this. But nope. Here we are again.
Yep. I mean, dude, it's one of those things where he may never get a new trial.
Yeah.
You know, you never know. It's like, you can't sit here confident about anything. You know, you'll hear the talking heads on it. And, you know, you'll hear both sides of it. There's no way those confessions are too in stone. But those confessions, man, you can't trust them. Why couldn't they have just done it honestly? Like, why did they have to do the things that they did in order to I would have trusted those confessions a hell of a lot more if he was making them in Cass County Jail.
1,000%. It was not the same Richard Allen in that initial police interview that was making those confessions. Very different person.
He was a shell. A shell of his former self. It was shocking, man.
Well, we will continue to watch it. And maybe 10 years from now, you got to go drive there again and sit in a courtroom.
I'm
going
to go out for sentencing, even though that's a foregone conclusion. Yeah. She's going to get the maximum possible. So, I follow the case, man.
Great reporting, Bob Mata. Thank you for being there and bringing us the latest every single day.
I've been missing you, buddy, so I'm glad I'm back.
back to our regularly
scheduled programs, yes. You know what I mean?
Bob Mata, defense attorney and host of the podcast Defense Diaries. Do go download and check that out. If you want more in this case, every single day. He did about a 3 to 4 hour recap, him and his wife, Allie Mata, doing an extensive deep dive into that case every single day. If you want to go through it, do check out Defense Diaries on YouTube or wherever you get podcasts. Now we're going to move on to this very same case from a different perspective, but a psychological perspective, not so much the legal repercussions and the ins and outs of that, but more so the ins and outs of our mind and how this affected the jurors, how this affected the family of those two girls who lost their lives, and how this very impactfully affected the brain and the mind of Richard Allen. Siobhan, thank you for joining us. What's been your reaction to this verdict?
Yeah, I was actually shocked because after hearing all the evidence, you know, I didn't know till we had gone through the trial. And even though we weren't able to have cameras in the courtroom, I think there were some remarkable reporters in the courtroom who brought us play by play everything mm-hmm. that had been admitted into evidence. For me, the fact that a man with the kind of psychotic mental break that he had certainly raised reasonable doubt about those confessions. And it seemed like the jury just went with the confessions without any consideration for the fact that the guy was not even in reality when he was saying those things. So I was very surprised.
What does that say about, I guess, the general public as a whole? You know, obviously there's plenty of people out there who understand mental health conditions and, you know, different states of mind for different situations. But the jury of your peers, it's just a slice, you know, supposedly of the general public. So we're just going to kind of speak on those terms. What does it say about our understanding of mental health conditions? I mean, this is a pretty obvious one. I mean, if the guy eating the Bible and his poop and running into a wall head first and then intermittently saying, I killed them, isn't enough to make a average person go, there might be something wrong with that guy. I'm not quite sure what is.
Yeah, it's shocking to me. And I, of course, find all the time people who don't understand what psychosis means, you know, because we throw the word around a lot. Oh, he's a psycho or she's a psycho, you know, and so we tend to think it means just somebody who's sort of out of control or somebody who's not very well put together. Mm-hmm. But it actually means, psychosis actually means a complete break with reality. So they often don't know who they are. They don't know where they are. They don't know what's true, what isn't true. And it's a brain condition. It's an illness. And it's, you know, the brain is an organ in the body, just like any other organ. It can become diseased. And the psychotic condition simply means that you can't trust what anybody says when they're in that state.
Mm-hmm. It's an analogy I just came up with because I always like making analogies. It's like operating your computer in safe mode, where it's like, okay, we see in the background all of these pieces of the individual are there, but you can't access them at that point in time. Mm-hmm. The thing, the computer is running. It can run, but it's just running on the very basics of it's aware of its surroundings. It can hear, it can talk, it can taste, it can do those sort of things. But the coding, the programs and everything that make that computer what it is, mm-hmm. the things that it can execute, can't access them at that point in time. They're there, but cannot be accessed. It looks like the computer you just had, but it's in safe mode. And that's mm-hmm. kind of, I'd almost say, like what someone in that state or maybe other states too could be analogized into as far as, look, yeah, this person is, it's in there, it's not coming out, and they're not reading it right now. And that's, yeah. You're just getting a very surface level thing of really not a complete picture of who that human being is. And they're not going to make the right decisions other than not even quite for survival sometimes either.
Right. Yeah, definitely not. And I've had clients who didn't even believe they were human anymore. One guy believed he was a robot. Another guy believed he was Godzilla. It's common for people to be hallucinating and believe that they're a celebrity. I had one person who believed he was JFK. And I mean, this is truly what their brain is telling them at that point. So how can you take anything that comes out of a psychotic person's mouth as the truth? You know, you just can't.
Why is it that, I mean, this case, for example, we had one, the prison psychologist who obviously had a lot of, you know, marks against her for basically trying to exploit this trial for her own gain with podcasts and such. And then you have another mental health expert who came in and said, yeah, there's something not right with him. He was psychotic. The prison one saying, no, I don't think he was. Is that just really just poor work? Is that just being a very inept clinician? I mean, what is that where you can have two people who are supposedly, you know, experts in this area having such varying opinions on something like a Richard Allen. I mean, this is kind of black and white, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah, I try to be hesitant about criticizing other clinicians, you know, publicly. But frankly, there are some that just aren't very good. And I also think that you see in the forensic, in the criminal settings, often you may run into people who have a bias. And because in prisons, they do often see people who are malingering or feigning illnesses mm-hmm. in order to get some kind of special treatment or benefits. I think they can look at everybody with a bit more of a jaded eye, assuming that people are faking when they start exhibiting these kind of symptoms. But from everything that was documented that came out in the trial, I don't see how that was a reasonable stand to take. And I think she was wrong.
In the case of Richard Allen, the jury seemed to take the side of, well, he must have been faking it. That's certainly what the prosecution wanted everyone to believe. They had their psychologist come on the stand, the prison doctor, and talked about all that. She believed he was competent. The expert that came in for Richard Allen, not remotely saying the same thing. Let's talk about faking it. Obviously, when you're behind bars, there probably is a lot of feigning. There probably is a lot of people who are trying to fake it so they can get moved to another facility or whatever their goal may be. How easy is it? How difficult, I should ask you, is it to recognize when someone is feigning versus not?
It can be difficult, and you really do have to spend time with people. One of the things that you look for is the behavior, if it's psychotic appearing behavior, depression or whatever, is it consistent over time or does it come and go? You know, obviously a person that's consistently mentally ill, that carries more weight than somebody who seems to have just these transitory symptoms. But you also look for the severity of it. And I think the thing that really tipped the evidence for me was the self-injury, the degree that he was banging his head on the wall, and then, of course, the eating feces, as I've said many times. I've never seen anybody feign by doing that, although it is something that sometimes people in a severe state of psychosis will do. And so I think it's something you have to spend time with. You have to look at the person consistently. And then, of course, as we've talked about, there are tests that you can give. You know, you can give more in-depth psychological tests that a person who's feigning, it will show up in a certain specific pattern and versus when a person is legitimately ill.
You know, they had all this time to try and figure out the answers to this question. Why did it seem so difficult to do that, in your opinion, in this case? Did they just not want to go down the roads to get the answers that would truly define what is going on? Because maybe the assumptions where they're left are more in play for a certain verdict versus not?
Yeah, it's very frustrating to me whenever I see professionals that don't seem to go the extra mile, you know, to get the right kind of information that they should have. And that's what it looks like to me, is that they just didn't bother. And if they didn't bother in this case, how many other cases are there where they just don't bother to find out what's really going on with someone? So it's very troubling.
There doesn't seem to be a lot of connection not necessarily connection, but I guess weight. The weight that those of us outside the criminal justice system put on mental health versus the criminal justice system itself. There seems to still be quite a big disconnect in understanding what certain things can do to people and how it drives behavior and ultimately drives behavior towards some of the crimes that we talk about. Is that an accurate observation?
Yeah. It's very poorly understood. And we like to think that when you have people who work in institutions that they're paying more attention to it, but clearly sometimes they're not. I've seen it a lot also with people in the military, because often it's another case I'm thinking of, with someone I was involved with some years back, but a young man became psychotic during boot camp. And they called it, he's playing crazy. And he became increasingly increasingly ill and increasingly psychotic. And by the time I came in to the situation, he had to be in 4-point restraints, held down in a hospital bed with a guard with a gun standing over him, which is not exactly a therapeutic situation. And it could have been caught early and he could have been given some medication. And obviously the military was not the right place for him. But the fact that they could not see this and that they had some degree of mental health staff who didn't understand what was going on either is really scary. So prisons, military, probably a lot of places in our different governmental institutions, it's not well understood and not treated.
I mean, it almost feels like they put people into these positions where it's like, they're good enough for what we want them to be. They don't know above this level, but above this level could actually backfire at us. So we're just going to keep them here and it can keep reinforcing our previous beliefs or misunderstandings of mental health. It seems like a dig in thing to me where it's like, well, this is how we've done it. This is what we believe. And, you know, I'm going to just keep going because that's how it's always been.
Yeah, very true. And how to make the system move ahead and despite the harm that may be coming to people who are caught up in it in some way.
What about Richard Allen himself after going through this? And let's assume, as I believe, you know, yeah, he went into a psychotic state and everything that he was doing from the running headfirst into the wall to eating his own feces to, you know, having lunch, you know, eating Leviticus, literally the Bible. When you have that and you come out of it, are you ever the same person again, or does that do some sort of irreparable, you know, damage or rewiring of the brain that you come out of the other side? I don't know. I mean, is there a difference in the person, or can the person be completely the same as they were prior?
It can go both ways. Certainly, looking at him, the little bit of time that we see him on camera, he does not look like a well man at all. He doesn't look like the man who was arrested at all anymore. So can, with the right medication and treatment and the right environment, could he come back to be essentially the same person he was before? It's possible, but it also wouldn't surprise me if he was left a bit of a shell of his normal self as well.
Sure. Let's talk about the actual investigation. Let's talk about how the court has handled this, Judge Frances Gull and her many rulings in this case. And I'm just trying to get a grasp on what is going on here. I mean, if we're going to assume there's nothing that's being covered up necessarily in terms of him having a connection or the actual murderer being somebody else that they all know and they're covering for. But I'm saying more so in the lines of bad police work, bad investigation. The community wants someone to blame for this. And seemed Judge Gull just, you know, wanted to ram this through in any way that was needed and didn't really take a lot of time to consider a lot of these factors. I mean, firing his attorneys at one point, really narrowing down the possibilities of what they could even argue in court. What's going on there? What's going on in that sort of environment where you got the judge that's kind of thinking this one way, you got the community, the law enforcement that's pretty much on the same page, and it's just all this group think of, okay, this is our case, this is what we're going to do. And it just seemed reality and common sense were left out of the equation in all of the motions leading up to this actual trial. And the thing is, that's where most of the big decisions are made, is in the motions leading up to a trial.
Yeah, it's really surprising and scary, isn't it? And it, none of it, as we've said for so long, it smells fishy. None of it has appeared to be transparent. And it just makes me wonder how many other cases are there like this, where somebody is just basically railroaded and the system is not working the way that we think it's supposed to.
I mean, is this something that you think commonly goes on in jurisdictions where you kind of got the city basically, you know, against the defendant, and there's no way that they're ever going to look at it fairly? I mean, that's the thing. Like nobody's even arguing, I think, for the most part, or saying Richard Allen is innocent. everyone's just saying, look, this is not a fair playing field to even determine that question.
Yeah, it seems like there should be a lot more protest than there is about it, just from what we know, what we've been able to see. It doesn't look right.
The family of Libby and Abby, obviously there is a verdict now. It's sure going to be appealed. Closure. I mean, that's a funny word. It's often, I think, used by people who haven't been through the trauma. And they're like, oh, we'll find a way to move on. Like, you never move on from something like your kids being murdered and not knowing who did it. I mean, justice is the only thing, I think, in many people's mind where you can maybe kind of start to move forward, move on a little bit while still living with that pain. How do you think they're coping with this? And I'm not trying to put words in their mouth. But yeah, they got a verdict. But I mean, they're not deaf. They're not immune to what the general population is saying, who also want justice for these kids.
Yeah, I wish there was some way to say, yes, people get closure and feel better. I don't know that this verdict would do it. And you know, not knowing them, I don't believe I've seen recent interviews with them since the verdict has come out. Yeah. So I don't know if they feel that they're any better off than they were before. It certainly doesn't look like it.
There's been some cases in the past where the victims' families don't agree with the verdict and they don't agree with the guilty verdict, and they come out and they challenge the system as well, because they want to find what's going on. I'm not saying that that's their opinion. I don't know their opinion right now. But just for, I guess, talking on a psychological basis and on a mental health basis, if you are in that situation, if you are a parent, and let's just, for the sake of everything, say maybe somebody's in that boat on in that family that goes, yeah, we got somebody here, but I don't think it's them. What is a healthy path to go forward on in something like this? Is it to continue, you know, divulging yourself into the story and diving into it and surrounding yourself with it and the sadness and the depression that that would bring on, you know, by continuing to fight for what you think is right to find justice? Or is there a time sometimes where, you know, as a clinician, you just say, look, you know, there's other people to fight this. For you mentally going forward, just, you know, try and disconnect from the drama, from all these things that are going on and things that you really can't control.
Yeah, I think everybody has a unique path with that sort of thing. And I always encourage people to take really good care of themselves, including their mental health, and have a balanced life. And if they feel like they still need to do something, you know, in some way to follow through a good fight in their mind, then you can do that, but you have to compartmentalize it and not make it the entirety of your existence. You still need love in your life. You need joy. You need, you know, good self-care. You need to have hobbies, interests, a career. And then if you still need to pursue justice in whatever way you do it, but do all those other things as well.
Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, thank you so much for your insight on this case and joining us to discuss. Now we're going to slide over to Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Robin, we've been talking about this one for quite some time. I know you had even emailed me when the verdict came in going, oh my gosh, I'm sorry I'm wrong, but I don't think you were. I think all of us felt the same way on this and really still do. What's been your reaction thus far, now that we have a verdict of guilty in the Richard Allen case?
I had so many emotions at the same time, Tony. It's this is one of those cases that's going to be with me, and I know a lot of people, the rest of my life, I think. Mm-hmm. Disbelief was my first one because I still haven't changed my thought patterns. I've done a lot of reflection. You know, it's like my first reaction was I must have a blind spot. Mm-hmm. I must not see something that other people have seen. I'm wrong. I mean, it was really self reflective and blaming myself for not seeing something that the jury saw. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going through my range of emotions. You know, I even reached out to you, as you know. I apologize. I must have been way off of what I said.
And I'm like, you're great. We all agree.
I know. And then I look at what Jennifer Hoffendeffer posted, yeah. and she does the same thing. She does a beautiful job of outlining the behavior arc. And I just keep going to data. I just don't see the pattern of his life that fits what he's accused of. And then I go, right after It's My Fault, I go immediately to the families. I'm like, gosh dang, I really hope they feel satisfied with the verdict, mm-hmm. because I still am just always about the victims in this thing. And the only victims left now are Richard Allen's family and the girls' parents and families. And I hope that they have satisfaction with this. But it's hard to it's just hard. It's just there's so many emotions in there. And then I'm like, well, you know, then I start looking at the defense attorneys. You know, what could they have done differently? What could they have done better? They were hamstrung with so many things, as I know we're going to go through. It's just unfortunately, from beginning to end, from everything you and I have looked at, analyzed, commented on, and all your other contributors, nothing has changed.
No.
And that's what's just disappointing. I still have not changed my mind on what I'm seeing and what I'm assessing, and yet he's guilty.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
You had a lot more self-reflection on this case than I did. When I heard the verdict, I'm like, they're wrong. I'm like, they're just wrong. They are just wrong. I was like, what did I get wrong here? I didn't get anything wrong. You didn't get anything wrong here. I mean, facts are facts. And it's not like you or me had some sort of inflated, maybe this could be possible story here. It's just based on facts and based on the data that is there. These are non-refutable things. The jury did not hear so many pieces of this case. Just as you said, is there something I didn't see? It's the other way, I think, Robin. It's what the jury didn't see. We saw everything. You know, in the mind of the jury, we saw too much. In the minds of the prosecution, we saw too much. They tried to tamper down anything they possibly can, and they played whack-a-mole to such an extreme on this case that it was spooky. It almost really makes you question, how is this part of our American justice system? How is one person or very few people allowed to have so much power over a case like this?
You know, you really hit it right there, too. That's the most disturbing thing about this case to me is, how can this happen? That mm-hmm. there's still so many... I mean, I get that, you know, even with the Koberger case or any of the other cases, you know, there's a lot of gaps in data. But in every other case you and I have talked about, and all these cases that I generally see, there's always going to be gaps. There's always going to be data that you wish you had, a weapon, a witness, or something like this. But there's always that lifestyle behavior arc that says it makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying he didn't do it. I'm just saying there's nothing that makes sense that he did it. That's what's missing for me. And they didn't allow that to come to light for the jury or during this prosecution. So after all my emotions of going around and self-flagellation and blaming, I'm back with you. I don't think we're wrong. It's not that I think he's innocent or guilty, because I want more data. And I'm not seeing it. And until I do, I don't think he's guilty.
Don't think that anyone could render a verdict in a fair manner based on what was presented to the jury. And again, I agree. I can't say he's guilty or innocent, but I certainly can't say he's guilty based on an unspent bullet that was in an area where people are hiking all the time. It is a hunting area. So you do have people that are going to have those in their pocket. You had how many officers wandering around the area as well at the crime scene? It's a very likely possibility a bullet fell from someone other than Richard Allen. And the science of, went through his gun. That's so bunk. I mean, run it through any gun, you're going to get some sort of a marking on it. And then to say it's specifically his without any evidence, mind you, there was no scientific proof that went into this that said, oh, yes, this is why, look, we even have this. Or that. There was nothing. It was just, this is what we think. Same with the guy, the officer that testified going, that's his voice. Okay, like what did you run it through? What's your testing method? Like what program did you do to identify and get a signature that it is his voice? Nothing. It was just his opinion. it was truly shocking that that you can have a judge just say, no, we're not going to let you plead all of these different, very possible, likely theories that even the investigators investigated or stopped investigating for no real great reasons, and not allow that in for your own defense. It's one of those things that's shocking. If you don't know how the court system works in this country, you don't understand that a judge can do this. I didn't understand that until I started diving into true crime. I'm like, really? A judge can just say, you can't defend yourself using these theories or these arguments? Yeah, it can be done. That's how this case was done. That's how we got to this.
I know. And just all these, just a handful of the other potential people they were looking at or could have looked at, their behavior arcs fit closer than his.
Oh, completely.
Even if there's like only one or two data points on them, that's one or two more than we, that came to light for Richard Allen. It just...
Yeah.
And also, I'm not a jury blamer, a victim blamer, you know, so I definitely, the jury did the best they could.
They did the best they could, yeah.
With the instructions that, because again, I don't know the instructions that they got. I don't know, you know, their perceptions. I did hear, I was on another show and someone's actually in the courtroom during it, and I'm pontificating like I am now about, you know, what I'm not seeing. And this person came out of the courtroom saying, oh, the jury's going to convict them. And I was like, really? Yeah. So I guess that the tenor in the courtroom was very different than, again, because we're not there, we're not experiencing it as they are. And also, you know, I really thought hard about this one too. I think they really wanted, and everyone wanted someone to be guilty. Yeah. They want to find, you know, so there can be closure. And I get that. I just wish we all felt better about this.
I agree. The scary thing is about a case like Richard Allen and the Delphi murders is that people want answers. And that's the families, the neighborhoods, the communities, everybody, they want answers for what happened to these two little girls. There's nothing wrong with that. But oftentimes when we go on the path of trying to find answers, we put the blinders on. We go down this path and we think we know what we're looking for. We try to find that. And in some cases, that leads us in a good direction because, you know, sometimes those instincts are correct. But they searched for 5 years for a man and they never found one. And then they go back to old interviews. And oh my gosh, look at this one. We completely dropped the ball. How did we not realize we had this one? And there's really not a whole lot in this interview other than railroading him. But they went back to that and they said, oh, well, there's this bullet. Maybe we should connect this. And the rest is really history. Yet there are so many people in this case that you had mentioned earlier were not looked into or was just kind of touched upon. It's shocking. And I'm going to talk about some of these names. And these people, I'm not saying they're the killer or the killers, but I'm saying this is bizarre that there wasn't more of an investigation into this. You have Brad Holder, the avowed Odinist, initially a suspect due to his religious affiliations with Odinism and his proximity to the scene. The defense argued that elements of the crime scene, such as the rune-like formations, pointed to the ritual Odinistic killing. It was deemed inadmissible by the court because they didn't want to hear about his involvement. Just inadmissible. There's no Odinism here. You have Elvis Fields, identified by the defense as a person of interest very early on, alleged connections to Odinism, weird statements he gave about the crime scene, and knowledge of specific details that were not publicly available. Yet he wasn't our guy. I believe he even went on my social media and even like posted like kind of recreations of the crime scene. But nope, he couldn't have anything. You got Keegan Klein, a convicted child predator who at the time was not a convicted child predator, literally communicating with Liberty German under the username Anthony Schatz, talking about meeting up, talking about getting together the day of the murder. Later, he's arrested on child pornography charges, and he's serving 40-some years in prison. And then, of course, you also have Ron Logan, the owner of the property, who is now deceased, has a criminal history to him, never charged, and the involvement was also not presented. None of these options were presented to the jury. If you don't have any of that, how are you going to make an educated decision?
You know, each one of these people, especially I'm going, was it Patrick Westfall?
That's the ones in jail. Yeah. Keegan Klein is in jail.
Keegan Klein. Look at, you know, just do our own thought experiment here, as we love to do. Mm-hmm. Each one of them, especially that one who's in jail right now for being in communication, for child pornography, how much easier would it have been to prosecute him?
Yeah. Even if he has an alibi, who else does he talk to? Who else did he say, hey, these girls are going down there today. I know about it. When you want to go? Because, I mean, if they're communicating to their predator buddies, however that works, that could be a if he's it's not him, it seems like he's a pretty solid lead.
So in my mind, again, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an expert on that aspect of all these things, but if you have all these potential people that you can reasonably say to yourself, especially this one right here or the other one, that says I could equally prosecute one of these people and have maybe an easier time showing this arc of behavior. And also, if you look at the stats, most of the time, unless they're a vagrant going through the area like we had in the Rachel Morin case, there is some knowledge and connection between the victim and the murderer. Mm-hmm. And we have that in at least in that one instance. And so what that does, and like you said, what the judge ruled out is reasonable doubt. If it could have been any of these other people, and I'm sitting here saying, well, that fits. It fits more than this and this, or at least equally fits. That's reasonable doubt to me.
It seems that what was pushed out of the case were all of the reasonable doubt options. It wasn't like, here's a fact, this is our killer. Because I don't know if any of these people are, but they all play roles in this universe of what right. is going on. And the fact that they didn't allow the jury to even hear those names or at least put them into context because they're all players in this. It is shocking and in no way, I think, fair. It's just one of the many, many options that Richard Allen will have here on appeal. Beyond the people that were brought into the case of Richard Allen or the lack thereof, because many of them never known, never made any sort of impact on the jury. It's going to be interesting to hear their reactions now that they're out of that position, if they're going to be kind of shocked by everything they weren't informed of. You have other pieces of evidence that never were heard. The Odinism theory, not touched upon at all. And I was saying towards the end of this trial, did we even need to go to Odinism? Because to me on the outside, it felt like the defense didn't do a very good job at all. It felt like the prosecution really pointed out all of the weaknesses. And I thought, well, Odinism really doesn't even need to be in there. It couldn't be. The judge wouldn't allow it. But I guess I was wrong. Maybe they did need the Odinism theory. Do you think the Odinism theory would have helped this case, or would it have pushed the jurors even further to the side going, that's too fantastical if we didn't have the rest of the context?
I think what could have helped is if you remove the label of Odinism and just put like a cult-like murder, mm-hmm. you know, or ritualistic type murder without an inflammatory or weird sounding label on it. Mm-hmm. You just say that, in other words, give it a reason, a motive for committing this murder was ritualistic, mm-hmm. Without giving it a particular label of meaning. I think that probably would have had more traction, just because it sounds better to the ear. I think if it's presented more in a pragmatic scientific way, not science of the supernatural or Odinism, but just mm-hmm. in a ritualistic kind of cult-like way, because there's tons of cases that there's cult-like ritual murders and things that happened. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you look at it, look at Lori Daybell Vallow. Mm-hmm. That was a wackadoo religious cult-like murder of her children that you didn't give any kind of religious label to. Mm-hmm. And if we had called that, you know, that it was Odinism, you know, that would have sounded a little weirder. Yeah. You know, see what I mean?
Yeah.
And also, you know, with these other people that had threads, I'll call them little red threads. You know, Richard Allen had one and they pulled on it. And these other potential people, they had these little red threads too. What they should have done is they should have done a deeper dive to see if they can pull that red thread and see if it dives deeper. And if it doesn't, because right now all these people look equal to me.
Yeah.
You know, they're all kind of here on the surface. That they went an inch deep instead of a mile deep on anyone.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's a great analogy. No, I mean, I feel very much the same. I mean, I feel like there's others that are standing out with far more interest than Richard Allen ever was.
Take a look.
Yeah.
If they go nowhere, okay, good.
Yeah.
Well, then we have less reasonable doubt.
Let's do the job first. Let's go down the line and see what we can find. The sketch is another big part of this case. None of them look like Richard Allen. But again, the prosecution, Gault specifically, said, no, inadmissible. The jury doesn't need to see the sketches that we all put out and said, this is our man. And he doesn't look a thing like the guy. That might be some reasonable doubt there that this person that people described doesn't look at all like your suspect. They also said, you know, this is a taller man. Any eyewitness who claims to have seen this man claims he was taller, like upper 5 feet, lower 6 feet. Richard Allen is 5'4". It's a pretty, you know, there's a big difference between 5'4 and 5'10 or 5'11. You can kind of mix it up, I think, anywhere in like the upper fives to lower sixes if you're just guessing how tall someone is. If you're in the lower fives, I think most people would guess you're in the lower fives. It's a pretty steep difference there by like a head. You're not going to, I guess, mix that up. I guess if you've been alive for any amount of time and know the basics of our measuring systems.
Guilt confirmation bias at play.
Yeah.
I really think that's it. And that interview really said it all to me. The transcript of his interrogation that they put out there was just they saw him as guilty and they went right to an accusation after a few minutes of rapport and trust where he starts disclosing and they immediately went into accusation from the very get-go.
What's interesting about all the video that they showed him, though, or that they showed the jury, there was ones of Richard not in that delusional state where he's just mumbling and going, I killed them, and then goes and eats, you know, Leviticus. You know, that's what he's been doing. He was eating the Bible. He was eating his own feces. He's running headfirst into a wall. And they're saying, well, see the video? He said he did it here. But where he's coming out of work from CVS and they're talking to him, totally different human being. One has not had a psychotic break. The other has because they've been in solitary confinement for that long. That's another one that really kind of shocked me. Does the general public, do jurors not understand? I mean, just the impacts of what that kind of torture will do to someone. I mean, even if it's spelled out for you, does the general public literally think, oh, I could stand that. I'm a strong man or I'm a strong woman.
No, you can't. Yeah. So, and I mentioned it in your other show too. I'm reading another one too. I'm reading I can't remember. So it's about Raoul Amundsen. This is the greatest adventurer and greatest explorer of the last couple hundred years. This guy is actually the first one to reach the South Pole. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned, you know, the voyage of the Jelka. I can't remember saying it. It's a Belgian ship that got trapped in the ice pack down there in Antarctica. And even back then, the science and understanding of what isolation does to the human being is profound. And I've had people say to me too, well, he got 1 hour of sunshine a day. He got to go out. That doesn't do it. It doesn't do it at all. These people were trapped with each other. There's like 14 of them. And they still had two that became insane and one committed suicide when they returned and one down there. The effect of isolation on us as a species is profound. We are not genetically and biologically coded to be alone. And when you're put in isolation like that, it does horrible things. But that's why we have all these NASA studies for the travel to Mars. And even before we went to the moon, because it's not about, yes, it's about the distance, about the radiation, all these things. It's about the human isolation and what it does to us.
Yeah.
And you have to pick very specific people that can actually handle that. And not many can, if any. And so when you take someone like Richard Allen, who may be right on the precipice because he's self-described as having some psychological issues, he says he's suicidal, where he can function completely fine if all things remain equal. But then when you just teeter him over that edge, like you would anyone in that isolation, all the behaviors, and the psychiatrist or psychologist, I can't remember which was, that the defense brought on that talks about the effects of isolation on the brain. They did a great job there. I don't know why they didn't harp on that more, because it has a severe, profound effect on us and our physiology. Just read any history book, read any explorer book where someone's exploring anywhere in the Arctic, you know, in the North Pole or South Pole from the, around the 1700 to 1800 timeframe. You will see exactly what I'm talking about. And this is just not, it's just us as a species.
Yeah. It's just how we work. It is what it is. I want these families to, you know, have closure. Yeah. I know that's a cliche thing to say. Yes. When you lose your kid, you're never truly going to have closure. But have something that brings some sort of end to this chapter. Just a bookend. The families being satisfied in some way, shape, or form, as much as you can after losing your child. I don't know if they are or not. I'm not trying to speak for them. I mean, from the perspective I have, if I was a parent of this one of these kids, I don't think I'd be very happy. I would feel like, well, yeah, we named somebody. But mm-hmm. I don't think I'd feel very confident about this. Do you think the families are satisfied? I mean, I suppose it's easier to want to fit the square peg in the round hole, and maybe they did it here. But I think deep down, you probably know, was this the right peg for the hole?
I don't know. I had a tail end of listening to someone, actually who was friends with the family, on another show. And there's a lot of emotion that's going on with everyone on both sides, both the Allen family and the victims' families. And it's one of those things I don't know the answer to that. I don't presume the answer to that. The challenge I would think that they're going to have is the fact that there's going to be an appeal. So the appeal process to me would not allow them to move forward. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what they need. It's one of those things, you just don't know what the families need. You know, like with all these other cases, I just want them to be satisfied.
Yeah.
I want justice and I want satisfaction for the victims. And I don't think we're there yet on this.
Yeah. One can only hope. What will happen next? It's likely going to go to appeals, and off of the laundry list of things that went wrong in this case, I would be shocked if he does not get an appeal or at some point. Now, that could take a long time. It might not be the first round. They're like, oh, yeah, you're good, depending on who it goes to. But, if Scott Peterson, if the Menendez brothers can get a second look at their case, this thing is screaming with inconsistencies that need a second look. It'll be fascinating.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what's that group coming in for Scott Peterson, the
Innocence Project. The
Innocence Project. This is ripe for the Innocence Project. There is no doubt.
Without a doubt. Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and author of many books, including this brand new one right here, Unbreakable Alliances. Please, it would make a great Christmas gift. Awesome insight into our behavior and alliances that we make in our lives and how they can positively impact our lives. Great Christmas gift. I do highly recommend checking out. Get that wherever books are sold. It's going to wrap up our program for today. A big thank you to all of our guests, Bob Mata, Siobhan Scott, and Robin Drake, for their insights. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for joining us. Until next time, be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of the stories we're following for you right here. Hidden Killers podcast from True Crime Today. Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
Let's be honest. Nothing kills the thrill of a good murder mystery like a commercial for laundry detergent. It's like someone slapping a closed sign on your favorite dive bar. But you're not here for that, are you? You're here for the good stuff. So ditch the ads and upgrade to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts. With True Crime Today Premium Plus, you get your crime straight. No chaser. commercial-free, with extended interviews and early access. It's like getting the bartender's special when the bar's already closed. Search for True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe and drink it all in.
You don't need to be ripped. You just need the right shirt. Epic Fits gives you a clean, confident silhouette. Snug on the arms, soft on the skin, generous where it counts. And with deals like $15 per tee, they won't break the bank. Visit epicfits.com today. Epic Fits, t-shirts that get it.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
You don't need to be ripped. You just need the right shirt. Epic Fits gives you a clean, confident silhouette. Snug on the arms, soft on the skin, generous where it counts. And with deals like $15 per tee, they won't break the bank. Visit EpicFits.com today. Epic Fits. T-shirts that get it.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.